Today is Monday, February 12th. We're going to focus today on heart information. Okay, so we're on page 36. So before we took the test, we were looking at just some basic heart information. Today I'd like to pick you back up with some heart anatomy. On page 36, we're going to talk about the four chambers of the heart. There are two superior atria and two inferior ventricles. Okay, so the atria on top are what they call receiving chambers. These are simply receiving blood under low pressure. And for that reason, you'll notice that the walls on these heart models don't have very thick myocardium, and that's because the pressure coming into the atria is pretty low. Okay, so let's take the right atrium first. Where does the right atrium receive blood from?
Superior vena cava.
Good. Superior vena cava, inferior vena cava, and a vessel that dumps blood from the heart? Coronary sinus. Good. You guys probably saw that little red dot in the right atrium. That is the opening to the coronary sinus, and it does return blood from heart circulation back into the heart itself, back in that right atrium. Now, is this blood coming from SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus? Oxygenated or deoxygenated? Deoxygenated, good. So why do they color these vessels blue?
Because it doesn't have any, the blood doesn't have any oxygen.
Good. Blood doesn't have any oxygen, good. Okay, now on the left side of the heart into the left atrium, there are four veins that dump blood here. These are called?
Pulmonary veins.
Pulmonary veins, good. And you've probably heard this before, but I'll go ahead and remind you. Arteries are red, veins are blue, but in the heart there's an exception of two, or sometimes it goes in the heart, flip the two. Pulmonary arteries and pulmonary veins, yep. So these four pulmonary veins are colored red because they in fact carry oxygenated blood into that left atrium. Good. Okay, so blood is going to drain through these open valves down into the ventricles simultaneously. So that means that when blood comes into the right atrium, it's also coming in at the same time to your left atrium, and blood is draining into these ventricles, and the ventricles are going to start to swell, just like a water balloon that you're filling up. Those walls start to stretch, those ventricles start to gain blood. So the two ventricles down below are what we call discharging chambers, and what that means is their job is to discharge or eject the blood from the heart. Where does the right ventricle send blood?
Pulmonary trunk.
Good. Pulmonary trunk. And of course, that takes blood to the?
To the lungs. Yes, the capillaries.
Good. And then we've got the left ventricle, which is really large and muscular. It takes blood where?
To the aorta.
To the aorta. Good. And that goes out to the body. You may notice in this picture, the right atrium is actually a little thinner, a little smaller than the left ventricle. Right ventricle is a little smaller than left ventricle. Why do you think that left ventricle is so large and muscular? Good, you got it. It goes to the whole body. So there is a blank for you to fill in there. Okay, that's page 36. That left ventricle is so large because it pumps blood out to the body. Pumps blood out to the body. Yeah. It's got to have extra force. All right, so left ventricle is larger because it has to have more force to pump blood out to the body. You know, keep in mind that that blood that leaves your heart has to make it to the top of your head and to the tip of your toes. So there has to be force behind it to make it into all these different locations. So we're considered, you know, a little more advanced than some animals in the animal kingdom. We actually have four chambers in our hearts as opposed to three or two. And the advantage is it helps us to keep oxygenated blood on the left side separated from deoxygenated blood on the right side. So there is a wall that separates the two chambers on the top and the bottom. We call that wall a what?
Septum.
Septum, good. You really can't see the interatrial septum, but there is one between the two atria up top. But you can see the interventricular septum down below. It is made mostly of myocardium, and of course that separates left ventricle from right ventricle. I know in lab you guys have probably seen the sulcus or grooves on the outside of the heart. Those grooves are where we're gonna look at, blood vessels laying. There's a lot of fatty tissue in there as well. So there's a groove that runs lengthwise. There's also a groove that runs around where these auricles sit as well. All right, that should do it for page 36. How about questions on that page? Let's hit the valves over on page 37. 4 is again our magic number here. There are 4 chambers and 4 valves for the heart. The 2 valves situated between your atria and ventricles are called atrioventricular valves. For short, we can call it the AV valves. We can also be very specific. The valve on the right side between your right atrium and right ventricle is also called tricuspid valve, good. And then on the left side, between left atrium and left ventricle? Bicuspid or mitral, good. So got a couple of names there to keep straight. That's one thing you guys will probably notice about the heart is there's multiple names for the very same structure. So you've got left AV valve, mitral valve, and bicuspid all refer to that same valve on the left side. So you may have heard this before. You may have heard to try before you buy. Tricuspid's on the right side, bicuspid's on the left side. Okay, tricuspid also has an R that reminds me of the right side of the heart. Now, those valves are anchored by heart strings. Those strings are called?
Chordates.
Good, and they're anchored to little muscles in the ventricles that stick up like fingers. Papillary, good. So, chordae tendineae are heart strings. They anchor to those papillary muscles in your ventricles. So the goal is to have these valves shut when your heart contracts. When your ventricles contract, they pull down on these heart strings. Those papillary muscles contract and pull down. And that should slam shut both of your AV valves at the same time. That way, we prevent blood from backflowing into which chambers?
Into the atria.
Into the atria, good. And instead of letting that blood backflow, we're going to force it out of the heart. The right ventricle forces blood up through the pulmonary trunk. And where does the left ventricle force blood?
Up to the aorta.
Up to the aorta, good. So this way we don't let blood backflow. We keep the pressure high and we force the blood out of the heart. Okay, so that takes care of those AV valves. Let's now talk about the semilunar valves. The semilunar valves, anybody else need the sign-in sheet? Y'all need it. Okay. Thanks. You've got it?
Okay.
All right, so we've got semilunar valves sitting at the base of your pulmonary trunk. You've got another one sitting at the base of your aorta. Good. And these are like little half moons, they call them semilunar. And basically, they're like trap doors. They stay shut, and they only open when blood forces through them. So these semilunar valves are meant to keep blood from backflowing down into the 2 ventricles. Thanks. All right, so when the right ventricle contracts, the tricuspid valve slams shut, and what happens to your pulmonary semilunar valve?
It opens up.
It opens up, good. Likewise, at the same time, when your heart contracts, your mitral or bicuspid valve slams shut, and where does blood then go from your left ventricle?
Aortic semilunar valve.
Right, force open that aortic semilunar valve and let the blood go into the aorta. Good. So these 4 valves are never, ever open at the same time. Okay? These 4 valves are never, ever open at the same time. But they are closed all at the same time twice. We'll come upon that in a page or two. So these 4 heart valves are never, ever open at the same time. Let's talk about coronary or cardiac circulation near the bottom of your page. So we spend so much time in this chapter talking about how the heart works as a pump. We sometimes forget that, oh yeah, this is an organ. It's a very muscular organ, and it needs to have its own blood. So that's where we come in with coronary circulation. Coronary circulation involves taking some blood and nourishing the heart muscle itself. And we're going to borrow that blood from a really large artery that leaves the heart. Which of these vessels leaving the heart carries blood out to the body?
Aorta.
Aorta, good. So, in fact, we're going to have some vessels, like you see here, that are attached to the base of the aorta, and they're going to borrow some of that oxygenated blood and give it to the myocardium here to nourish it. There are about 9 major coronary arteries that sit on the heart surface, and their job is to nourish this myocardium with oxygenated blood. You can see them on the front and the back side, okay? So there's a good reason that those coronary arteries are not embedded inside the myocardium. Let them pass by. What would happen to those vessels if you had the blood flowing through every time the heart contracted?
They wouldn't be able to go to all parts of the heart because they'd be going with the rest of the fluid.
Yeah, and if you squeeze the muscle tissue and you had a vessel flowing through there, you would squeeze the blood flow off. Yeah, so if you have the vessels on the surface of the heart, then you don't have that issue with every time the heart contracts that you're going to cut off blood flow to a certain area. So that's why you can see these coronary arteries on the surface of the front and back side of the heart. There's about 9 major arteries, like I mentioned. One of the most important ones is this one, this left anterior descending artery. Where do you think it's taking blood? So which chamber do you think is getting blood?
The left ventricle.
Left ventricle. And why is it so important for that left ventricle to get blood?
Because without the left ventricle, you won't be getting blood to your body.
Good. Yeah, that ventricle pumps blood out to your body. And of course, if you've got problems with that ventricle, then you've now got problems affecting your entire body. So if there are blockages or perhaps, say, an inflammation that ruptures in that vessel, they call this one the widowmaker. It's a heart attack that can cause blood to be not delivered to that left ventricle, and that can kill a person because now we affect that aorta. Let's see. You've also got some blue veins on the surface of the heart. These coronary veins pick up blood after gas exchange has occurred. And for most of us, the veins dump into a large vessel on the back side. You know the name of this one? Coronary sinus. Yeah. So for most of us, the blood drains into the back side of the heart. That coronary sinus is where we pick up most of our deoxygenated blood from coronary circulation. And to what chamber does that coronary sinus dump blood?
Into the right atrium.
Right atrium, good. So the way coronary circulation works is you borrow some blood from the aorta, and then you dump the blood that's already been oxygenated and now is low in oxygen back into the right atrium. So it's a way to nourish the heart itself with its own oxygenated blood. I wanted to show you what happens when there are blockages. This is coronary bypass surgery, sometimes called coronary artery, or CABBAGE for short. And in this case, they may do a heart catheterization to see how many blockages a person, patient has around their heart. And if they find some blockages that maybe need repair as through this surgery, they may say, we think we're going to do like a 3-way bypass. And when they actually get in there and start doing the surgery, they may have to do a 4-way or a 5-way bypass. Since there's 9 major arteries serving the heart muscle tissue, you can have as many as a 9-way bypass. That's a lot of bypasses. So what are they bypassing that blockage with?
A blood vessel.
Blood vessel, good. And where do they get this new blood vessel from?
Get it from the coronary artery.
Get it from your leg. They strip out a vessel there. They may strip one from the arm. They've even stripped them from the chest, like a mammary vessel. Do you think they are going to strip out an artery in the leg or a vein in the leg?
A vein.
A vein, right. Why take a vein?
Because the arteries is what's giving
the oxygen and the blood to your body.
Good. So if you take an artery out, now you've got more problems for that body part, right? So we're going to learn in the next chapter that veins are built differently than arteries. They're not as strong and stretchy as arteries. So if you do something like take a vein from a leg and you place it over a blockage, that vessel's not going to last but about 20 or 30 years. So if you've got a patient who's, say, 40 years old and has bypass surgery, you know, at age 70, if they're still around, they may be looking at another bypass surgery. So those vessels just don't work, and they don't wear out the same way that those coronary arteries do. So nowadays they're doing some pretty cool stuff. They do keyhole surgery, which they go between your ribs. They don't crack open the chest and do surgery that way. And, you know, they're hopefully finding new ways to do this kind of replacement without having to have such an invasive chest opening surgery. All right, so that should do it for page 37. How about questions on valves or coronary circulation? So page 38 is blood flow through the heart, and like I mentioned, on the test I may ask you to start at some random point and just cycle me all the way back through. So why don't we practice that? The page 38 starting point is SVC, IVC, coronary sinus, but let's just pick the pulmonary trunk as our starting point, and we'll just circle all the way back through and make that our ending point as well. So if we start with the pulmonary trunk, we travel to the pulmonary arteries, and then where?
To the capillaries and the lungs.
Good. Arterioles and then capillaries in the lungs. We do gas exchange there. And then we come back to the heart by way of pulmonary venules and veins.
Yes.
Good. And now what chamber do we dump this blood into?
The left atrium.
Left atrium. Good. We travel through a bicuspid or a mitral valve. Where next?
To the left ventricle.
Left ventricle. Good. Now that blood flows through the
aortic.
Good. And from the aortic semilunar valve, we now exit by way of the
aortic.
Good. Now
so
we travel.
For bicuspid, if we put left AV valves, that's fine.
Oh, yeah. Mitral, any of those words will work. Yeah. When you leave the aortic, you travel through the body's arteries and then the arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins. Good. Now you're going to return to the heart in either SVC or
IVC.
Good. Or even you could come back from coronary circulation by way of that coronary sinus. Okay. And so what chamber are we now in? Good. Right atrium takes you through the tricuspid valve and now down into the
right ventricle.
Good. And when the heart contracts, we're going to pump that blood up through the
pulmonary simulator.
Back to where you started, right? So now you're back at that pulmonary trunk. So I just want to reiterate, this is a circuit. You can make any point in that page 38, your starting point. And I would encourage you to do that. Just pick a starting spot, go all the way through, and make it that your ending spot as well. That way you feel comfortable for the test. So along these lines here of talking about circulation, there are in fact two circuits built into blood flow. There is a pulmonary circuit or a pulmonary circulation, and there's a systemic circuit or circulation. So if you're talking about the heart's role in systemic circulation, which chamber and vessel take blood out to the body? So which chamber and which vessel take blood out to the body? Left ventricle. Good. And the
aorta,
that's right. So those are part of systemic circulation that takes blood out to the body for oxygenation. And if you're talking about the pulmonary circuit, now you're talking what? Right?
The right atrium.
Right ventricle and the
pulmonary arteries.
Pulmonary arteries, good, good. So like we talked earlier, each side of your heart's dedicated to a particular function. Left side is really working on systemic ejection, and right side is sending blood to that pulmonary circuit. I know you guys are done with the heart for lab, and I, you're past that point, but I did want to mention, in case you need this, there are models that you can check out from the library right here across the hall. So if you're working on something and you really would like to take it home, check and see if they have it. If they don't carry the model that you would like to check out, either tell them or tell me, and I'll be happy to work with them to get those models stocked. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this slide. Okay, looks like we're ready to head on over to page 39. Even though this picture from the CDC is a few years old, about a decade old, it really hasn't changed much over the past 10 years. You'll notice that the darker red areas on this map represents heart disease, and wow, here in the South, we are in the thick of heart disease. They actually have said in recent years that Colorado, right here, is the healthiest state in the United States, along with Hawaii, and the reason for that is people get outdoors and do a lot of outdoor activities. So it looks like down here in the hot and humid South that, you know, perhaps we need a little humidity break to be able to get outside and do more activity. In addition to lifestyle and being, you know, sedentary, what also is going on here in the South? Diet, right?
Fried chicken.
Fried chicken, yeah. We, you know, they say that Southerners love their fried foods, and of course, that does contribute to heart disease. So interesting to look at this chart here and see what areas of the country are high in heart disease. And interesting and not a surprise here, stroke also follows the same color zones. So where we have high heart disease, we also have high stroke areas, and we also tend to have high areas of diabetes in a lot of these same areas. So a lot of those disease parts overlap. These links are in D2L, so I just want to tell you that there's a lot of good resources out there. There's a MedMovie link. This Utah website has EKGs, but these are all currently in D2L if you would like to link to them and take a look at them. If you find something else that's helpful, let me know. I'd be happy to share it with everybody. All right, so on the top of page 39, we are looking at what's called a cardiac conduction system, and we are going to talk about two things, an intrinsic conduction system and a autonomic override system. So when you think about the heart's muscle tissue, there is not just muscle tissue in the myocardium, but there's also built-in interwoven nervous tissue. And the heart is unusual in terms of how muscles work. The heart actually can depolarize and contract all by itself. How do most muscles operate? Do they do that spontaneously? Got to get a signal from the brain, right. So the heart is unusual in the fact that it has its own built-in nervous tissue, and it can contract spontaneously and independently of external nerve stimulation. This sounds like a Frankenstein story I'm about to tell you, right? Okay, so let's talk about these two systems. You have an intrinsic system, and that means the heart's own built-in nervous system. So the heart keeps pace at its own rate, which works out to be about 75 beats per minute. Okay, that is a blank down there on your page for you. Normal pace is around 75 beats per minute. There's also a set of blanks for the range. 60 to 100 is considered the normal range. 75 is considered the normal pace. The normal range is considered to be 60 to 100 beats per minute. All All right, so by itself, the heart sets its own pace. It says, I do my own thing, I listen to the beat of my own drummer, and nobody has to tell your heart how fast to beat. Basically, the heart is going to set its pace at 75 beats per minute. Now, if something demands a faster heart rate or a slower heart rate, there is an override system. It's called the autonomic nervous system, and you may have heard of this one before. This automatic nervous system has two branches, a sympathetic branch and a parasympathetic branch. So if you need to speed the heart rate up, which branch should you use?
Sympathetic.
Yeah, use sympathetic. And if you want to slow down the heart rate, you'll use parasympathetic nervous system branch. So going back to the top of your page there, I know you've jotted down your normal range, 60 to 100 beats per minute. The normal heart rate for most people at rest is around 75 beats per minute. I want you to notice that word there, tachycardia. What happens to the heart rate here?
Fast.
Fast, right. So in excess of how many beats per minute? Yeah, 100's the cutoff. So anything higher than 100 is considered tachycardia. If you exercise, you induce tachycardia. If somebody scares you, or if you're excited or nervous, you can induce tachycardia. But normally, you should not be sitting in a classroom having a heart rate of 110 beats per minute as your norm. Okay. The other term there is called bradycardia. This is under how many beats per minute?
60.
Under 60, good. You know, the Olympics are on right now, and if you happen to catch them talking about the athletes and their athleticism or their workout or whatever, they will sometimes say, this person is so well-toned of an athlete that the resting heart rate is like 30-something beats per minute. And knowing what we know, 60 to 100 being the normal range, where does 30 beats per minute put that person? Yeah, that puts them in bradycardia, right? Okay, so the catch is, if you're an athlete and you exercise and you push your body really hard, this myocardium becomes bigger, and we say that it hypertrophies. So what that means is, when your heart does contract, it is so strong that when it sends a contraction and pushes blood out, it's really efficient. So that means that you can get away with having, say, 30 or 40 heartbeats per minute. For another person, maybe that person is not an athlete, if their heart's not really muscular and their heart is beating 30 or 40 times a minute, what do you think? You think they're pushing out enough oxygenated blood?
They're getting in trouble.
They're getting in trouble, yeah. So on the low end of the scale, if you're in bradycardia and you're not an athlete at the Olympics, then you're looking at not sending enough oxygen to your cells and tissues. Same issue comes on the high end there. If you're, say, at 150 beats per minute, your heart is beating so fast that you can't adequately eject enough oxygenated blood with each cycle out into those cells and tissues. So we run into oxygen perfusion to cells and tissues on those low and high ends. Does this stuff make sense so far? How about any questions so far? All right, so what is the heart's built-in nervous system called? Intrinsic, good. And what is the override system called?
Autonomic,
good. So which one normally sets the pace of around 75 beats per minute?
Intrinsic,
good. And if you need to slow down or speed up that rate, that's when we invoke that autonomic nervous system. So I'd like to walk you through the steps of the intrinsic built-in nervous system. This picture calls it the cardiac conduction system. That's just another name for your intrinsic conduction system. So I'm going to start you off with the pacemaker, and the pacemaker is known as our sinoatrial node, or SA node. Where is it located?
It's located right atrium.
Good. So it sits at the top of that right atrium. So in order to be the pacemaker, you have to have the fastest pace. So that means for most of us, our sinoatrial node sets the pace of around how many beats per minute?
75.
About 75, good. When that sinoatrial node sets the pace of 75 beats per minute, it sends nerve impulses across the walls of the two atria. And there's an acetylcholine molecule that's released from those neurons. What does acetylcholine tell muscles to do?
Contract.
Contract, good. So the SA node tells the atria to contract by releasing acetylcholine. When the right atrium contracts, it pumps blood down into the right ventricle. Likewise, left atrium sends blood into the left ventricle. So those two atria contract simultaneously. They pump their blood down into the next chamber. We don't need a lot of muscle tissue because the pressure here is fairly low. About the time that blood is being pumped into your ventricles, the nerve impulse reaches our number two in charge, and that is your AV node. AV stands for atrioventricular. So where is it located?
A little bit. It's kind of like right in the right atrium, too, but a little below it.
Good. Base of the right atrium. Some textbooks say it sits close to the interventricular septum. We're kind of in that neighborhood, bottom of the right atrium, up against that interventricular septum. So it is our number two in charge, and when it receives a nerve impulse from your SA node, it now fires off an impulse of its own. That impulse travels through this connection right here. It's called the bundle of His. I don't know where they get the name from. Obviously, it was some dude who discovered this. Nowadays, they call it the junction. They call it like an AV junction, or they'll call it an AV bundle. But the older name for it is bundle of His. Notice how that bundle splits into branches. There's a left branch, there's a right branch. And those branches then travel up the walls of your ventricles. And those little tiny fibers in the walls of your ventricles are called Purkinje fibers. Finally, those Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine onto the walls of your ventricles. And what do your ventricles now do?
They now contract.
They now contract, good. And so your right ventricle pumps blood out through your pulmonary trunk. And where does your left ventricle pump blood?
Into the aorta.
Into the aorta, good. This took me, 2 minutes to tell you the story? In reality, it's 0.8 seconds. So this conversation we just had, we were extremely bradycardia, weren't we? Okay, so this conversation is going on here, SA node firing, then AV node firing, and ventricles contracting. This whole cycle is about 0.8 seconds. So if you've got your highlighter handy, this page has some things to highlight. I would know 75 beats per minute is the norm. I would also highlight 60 to 100 is an acceptable range. Okay, 75, 60 to 100. This is another good number to know. 0.8 seconds is a good range for the cardiac cycle. Okay, this chapter is about storytelling. If you can go home and tell somebody the blood flow through the heart, use a picture if you need to, and then walk them through the cycle. Same thing here. This is about telling a story. So let me get an animated one up and we'll walk through it. The SA node has to fire first. It tells what chambers to contract.
The left and right atrium.
All right.
Good, left and right atrium. Then there's a pause. Because we're sending the message to our number two in charge,
AV.
And that is
AV
node, good. AV node now sends off an impulse to this bundle of His. It splits into these bundle branches and then terminates with these Purkinje fibers in the walls. When those Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine, good, ventricular contraction, good. So this whole cycle is meant to give our atria an opportunity to contract first, pause, let the ventricles fill up with blood, and then tell the ventricles, okay, now you're on, and then tell them to contract second. So the pause is there between atrial contraction and ventricular contraction to make sure that we're ejecting enough blood out into circulation. What if you don't send enough oxygenated blood? How might you feel?
Weaker,
tired, lightheaded, okay? So we're trying to make sure that we're ejecting enough blood every time we let those ventricles fill and then pump out adequate oxygenated blood. So if somebody's SA node fails to be in charge, who takes over?
The AV.
AV node, our number two in charge, takes over. And how fast does it beat? It does not beat as fast. It is about 40 to 60 beats per minute. And so if AV node becomes your number one in charge, then you've got bradycardia. Yep, so we don't want that SA node to fail. People sometimes have heart attacks or heart muscle damage, and that SA node can no longer be the number one in control. And so some other piece of nervous tissue, like the AV node, may step up and say, hey, I'm going to be the one in charge. So they may give that person a pacemaker to make sure the heartbeat is going fast enough and that we don't have to rely on that AV node to be the number one in charge. All right, so here we go. SA node fires, atria contract, AV node fires, bundle of His, bundle branches, Purkinje fibers, ventricles contract. There is a pause in there between your SA node firing and your AV node firing. Why do we need a pause?
So the atria can fill up with blood.
Good, so which ones can fill up with blood?
Ventricles,
good. And that way when they pump blood out into their pulmonary and systemic circuits, we're getting enough blood sent to the lungs and to the body. Good. So this is just a story I would repeat. Go down to the list. There are about seven steps there on the bottom of page 39. I would just work myself through that until I could tell the story without having to read it. And you're welcome to download this one. This is Heart PowerPoint number 2. And you can watch the animation and talk along with it. There's several of them up here. All right, so let's talk about autonomic override control. If your heart rate is too slow and you're not delivering enough oxygenated blood to your cells and tissues, then the sympathetic nervous system may be turned on. What neurotransmitters target the heart?
The epinephrine and norepinephrine.
Good, epinephrine and norepinephrine. And what do they tell the heart rate to do?
Increase.
Yep, speed up, right. So that way we can then get enough oxygenated blood out for delivery. Let's talk about if you need to slow your heart rate down. Now you're going to use the parasympathetic nervous system, and we're going to use the vagus nerve. And now which neurotransmitter is going to be involved? Acetylcholine. Good, good. So if you want to invoke your parasympathetic nervous system, what kind of frame of mind do you need to be in?
Calm.
Not excited, right? Okay, so take long, deep breaths. You know, calm yourself down, and you'll put that parasympathetic nervous system in charge. And of course, that will slow the heart rate. So this kind of sounds like meditation, doesn't it? Yep, so they say that that kind of activity can help put your parasympathetic in control. How are you doing with this page? Any questions on it? We want to let those ventricles fill up with blood. Because if they don't fill up with blood, we're not going to pump out enough into circulation. So give them a pause so we can let those ventricles fill with blood. Let's hit this one more time from the top to make sure we're good. Where is your pacemaker?
SA node.
Yeah, SA node. It sits in your right atrium. Good. And when it sends out a nerve impulse, what chambers contract in response?
The atria.
Atria, good. The atria then send their blood to what chambers next?
Ventricles.
The ventricles, good. So there's a delay here, there's a pause before we tell number two in charge, that AV node, to send off a nerve impulse. Now when it does receive the impulse from the SA node, it sends it down a bundle of His to what next?
after that, bundle branches.
Bundle branches, good. Those branches then terminate with?
Purkinje fibers.
Purkinje fibers, good. Those Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine, telling your ventricles to?
Contract.
And from SA node to AV node to ventricular contraction, this whole cycle is how long?
Point 8 seconds.
0.8 seconds, good. So this is something you could take home and teach to somebody, and I think that will help you get this one to stick. Any questions on this page? We'll talk more about drugs and tachycardia and bradycardia as we get further into this stuff. So we'll come back and eventually get that topic covered. All right, so in the last little bit here, what I'd like to do is introduce you to the EKG. This is known as an electrocardiogram. It is an electrical recording of the heart's activity, and it may also be called an ECG. So we're not looking necessarily at muscle contractions. We are looking more at the movement of ions into and out of cells. So let me take you back to Bio-210 for just a moment. Just jog your memory. Okay, so during resting potential, what ions are normally inside cells? Potassium. And where's sodium normally located?
Outside.
So if you're at resting potential, you're not getting a bunch of ion movement at this point. But if you depolarize those cells and you open up these sodium gates, what now comes into your cell?
Sodium.
And what happens to the charge inside your cell?
It becomes
positive. Good. So it's the movement of ions and the change in charge that we're picking up on those EKGs. So if you're just sitting here at rest, like you see in this picture, you're not going to pick up anything on an EKG. But once you start getting ion movements like sodium's rushing in or even potassium's leaking out, that's going to change the charge environment inside your heart muscle cells, and that is what we're going to pick up on an EKG. So I should mention to you also that any kind of physical movement, like if you move your arms and legs during the EKG, that also shows up on the reading. I know you guys have probably heard stories about people being picked up in the ambulance and they're actually dead, and they hook them up to an EKG monitor, and the body's being jostled as the ambulance is driving, and you know the body's moving. There's really no heart activity, but it shows up as a little bit of activity because the muscles may be moved. So, yeah, your skeletal muscle activity can actually influence EKG, what we're reading on that paper. Nowadays, EKGs can be done completely digitally. They don't have to have a printout unless they want to. But if you are looking at a printout or one on a digital screen, there are some things to know about it. These teeny tiny blocks here, they are 0.04 seconds. We're not going to worry with the tiny blocks, okay? Can you see the bigger blocks on here? There should be 25 tinies in that big block, okay? Those bigger blocks are equivalent to 0.2 seconds. That's good to know. Okay, the big blocks are 0.2 seconds. And that is good to know. They call it a large square. It's not really scientific, is it? Yeah, but just it's a big block of 25 little squares.
First time they didn't get fancy with the name.
Seriously, they actually went with something common sense here. So if you would like to label on your picture, let's say that this point right here is 0 seconds. Okay, right here on the bottom is 0 seconds. I'm going to come over one big square, and this point here is 0.2 seconds. So zero in the corner, here's 0.2. This is easy, right? 0.4. Yeah, next is point six, point six, point eight, and then there's one full second. So earlier we talked about a cardiac cycle being about 0.8 seconds. And if you say, okay, our starting point is right here about at the P wave, I'm just gonna say that's my starting point, and we end down here right after this U wave, well, that's about 0.8 seconds, right? So that kind of goes full circle in confirming that our cardiac cycle should be about 0.8 seconds. By the way, this is what they consider to be a normal sinus rhythm. It is a very pretty picture, and we wouldn't necessarily expect to see this for every one of our own heartbeats. And it's certainly something you have to lay very still to accomplish, but there's a lot of things going on with our heart, depending on how hydrated we are, how many ions we have available for the heart to use. So we may in fact have this one time and perhaps not another time and still be completely okay. Let's see, one more thing here. If you see upward spikes on the EKG, that simply indicates where the nerve impulse travels relative to the electrodes that are placed on your body. And if you see downward spikes, all that means is those nerve impulses are traveling away from those electrodes. So the reason I mention this is because when you see upward spikes, don't necessarily assume that the muscle tissue is becoming positively charged, and don't assume that a downward spike means that the tissue is becoming negatively charged. That's not the relationship. All those spikes mean is where the nerve impulse travels relative to the electrodes that are placed on the body. Upward spikes are toward the electrodes, downward spikes are away. So if you see the picture on your worksheet, that's a classic looking EKG. If the waves are inverted and going in the opposite direction, what does that tell you about the electrodes placed on the person's body? Backwards. Yeah. So wherever they were supposed to place the electrodes, they put them in reverse. So the electrodes are supposed to go in a certain location, and if you see spikes that are going down that should be going up, basically tells us the electrodes are reversed. All right, anybody still need this slide? All right, so I'm gonna help you label this thing. So this is going to help us tie in what we just covered. Who is your pacemaker?
The SA node.
SA node, good. What does the SA node send out a message to the atria? What is that message?
To contract.
To contract. And we know from Bio210 that before you can contract, you have to do what?
You have to reach threshold.
You got to reach threshold, and that means you've got to fully depolarize, right? Okay. So right here before your P wave, I'm going to put a little mark, and we're going to have our SA node fire right before that P wave shows up. And of course, that is going to tell our atria to, hey, get ready to contract. So the SA node is our pacemaker. It sets the whole heart rate here. And so it sends an impulse telling your atria to get ready to contract. The very first wave you should see showing up here is called a P wave. It's not a huge wave. And that's because there's not a whole lot of muscle tissue in your what?
In your atria.
In your atria, good. So we're now seeing the atria begin to depolarize. That's what the P wave represents. So P wave, atria depolarize, that means they're getting ready to contract. So let's take this from the top. We know the SA node fires first, the atria depolarize, they're going to eventually contract. There's a pause there because we want to let the blood fill into those ventricles. About that time, our number two in charge receives a message and now fires off an impulse. Who's the number two in charge?
The AV node.
AV node, good. So right before this QRS complex, that little flat space right there, I'm going to put the note. This is where your AV node fires an impulse. So if the P wave, tiny little P wave, is atrial depolarization, what do you think QRS wave represents?
Ventricle.
Ventricle depolarization, good. But why is the QRS so huge?
Because the ventricles have a lot more impulses going in, so they have to push the blood.
And tell me about the muscle tissue. Which chambers have more muscle tissue?
The ventricles.
That's why, yeah. So you've got more muscle tissue in the ventricles. You're going to have a much larger depolarization event. That's why you see a huge QRS wave. More muscle tissue, greater degree of depolarization. So that question on your worksheet, why is QRS wave so huge? Well, the ventricles have more muscle tissue, it's a greater degree of depolarization. Okay, so what you actually cannot see is an atrial contraction event. If you were to see it, it would be hidden behind this QRS complex. So if the atria are contracting behind the QRS complex and the ventricles are actually depolarizing at that time period, then what you see next is a little bit of a flat line right there. And so that flat line is the time period when your ventricles are actually contracting because the T wave represents ventricular repolarization. What does it mean to repolarize a muscle cell?
It appears to be on fire again.
Yep. Pump out your ions, right? You get everybody back to their location. Sodium's outside, potassium's inside. So you've got to have ventricular contraction somewhere in this flat space. Because during that T wave, ventricles repolarize. Thank you. don't need to know you. It is papillary muscle repolarization. You know, if now you know what it is, but you don't have to know that for the test or anything. U is papillary muscle repolarization. I'm going to repeat this stuff with you on Wednesday. So bring questions, you know, anything that you got here, and then we'll talk further about EKG stuff on Wednesday.